comes on. I hope it doesn't blast me.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everybody, from cloudy Westchester County. This is MJ Network. MJ stands for my sister, Marcia Joyce, because I named it after her because I miss her. And today is going to be absolutely one of those 10-star shows. Robert Dagoni has received rave reviews from Associated Press. Robert Dagoni has crafted a thriller with The Eighth Sister, which is one of my favorites for this year, that echoes the best of classic Russian literature with a hint of John Le Clair added to the mix. When the storyline veers into predictability, the narrative takes a drastic turn and becomes a legal drama that will remind readers of Scott Turow's best. This novel is destined to be a classic in the genre. And I quote, and it's in bold, Dagoni is arguably one of the best writers in the field right now. There is no doubt about that. And I am excited, and welcome to NJ Network, and I am really thrilled that you are here.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on, and it's a pleasure to talk to you again.
It is. It's great. And I'm sorry I missed you at the Thriller Fest last year, but I hope we get there this year. So what made you write this, and what kind of research did you do into the FSB and to create these KGB characters? They're, like, so real.
Yeah, so, you know, the story kind of came about, I was sitting at home. And I received an email from a gentleman who said that he loved my writing and he had just finished reading The Drinking Master.
Mm.
I have a story idea. You know, I don't really pursue that very often. Most of the time I just say, well, you know, thank you and leave it at that. But he then emailed me like 2 days later that he had read the next in the David series. And he really loved it. Copy, and again, I couldn't afford it. 2 days later, he had finished the next book in the series, and I confirmed that he's a legitimate businessman here in Seattle, and you know all the things you worry about a little bit. And you get kind of excited to have coffee with him, just before I went to get coffee. I decided to Google his name one more time and look him up, and I went through about three or four Google pages, and I found an article from the 1980s about a CIA officer who was acquitted of espionage, and he had a very similar name to the guy that I was going to meet. And the short of a long story is when I went to have coffee with him, we sat down, and I said, are you aware that there's this article out there? And he said, that's me. So we talked for about an hour or two, and when it was done, I said to him, you know, your story is obviously very compelling, but I don't want to tell your story because it's not sexy in today's market. It's not sexy in 2019. It might have been in the 1980s, but not now. So I said, but you know, I have this kind of interest in bringing back Charles Jenkins, and I have this idea. And if you would help me with the espionage, perhaps I could write, you know, a story that takes place in Russia, which is very sexy right now, and it kind of incorporates the trial to a limited extent that you went through. And he agreed. And so Kristen Hanna once told me when she wrote The Nightingale that sometimes stories fall in our lap and our job is to just get out of their way. And I kind of feel like that's what happened with this story. It just kind of fell in my lap and I needed to get out of the way and just write it.
And you really did. This really is fantastic. And I have to tell you, I have one copy in hardcover and one in softcover, and there are about 10 people that are waiting to see who's getting them. Seriously. And you know what the funny part is that usually when I tell people, because I walk around telling everybody I'm so excited I'm doing this, that I'm interviewing someone, everybody actually knows who you are, which is rare, because usually they go, who?
Wow.
I know I don't. They everybody reads you, yeah. So I've got a lot of people that want the book, and I told them I'm going to introduce you to Amazon. I figure that's a better way.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Yes, my.
But
my
it was
sense
really,
of humor
really
today.
Fun.
So, Charlie Jenkins is a great character. So what led him to go down the spiral road? And he had CJ security and financial trouble. So how did this lead him to decide, maybe I'm going to take a different role? And
I don't know if he's happy that he did. Yeah. No, you know, the same thing that really influences, I think, you know, all of us, which is family. You know, he has a family. He got married much later in life. He has a wife who's much younger than him. And he has, you know, he's a 9-year-old boy, and he's got a baby on the way. And his business is failing, and you know he's struggling. He signed personal guarantees on bank loans that to get his business off the ground. His the company that he works for is not paying him. They're in arrears, and he's really in a bad situation. And in the midst of being in this bad situation, his former station chief at the CIA in Mexico City shows up on his front porch and basically has this offer for him. And, you know, it's one of those things that I think, you know, everything is contrived, and Charlie doesn't realize this when this first happens, but, you know, everything is sort of contrived, but the motivation is basically what motivates all of us, which is to provide our family with a good life and to support them and to be able to take care of them. And, you know, Charlie's concern is that he's not going to be able to do that.
I know that's scary, and he's older, so that makes it even harder for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, how did he manage to stay afloat at first, and what caused him to take this? What role did he play originally in the CIA? And Emerson, you just said, why did he appear at his home for what purpose? I didn't like that guy at all. Seriously.
Yeah, you know. Charlie was a CIA officer in Mexico City back in the day, and he had served in Vietnam, and CIA knocked on his door because he had an affinity for foreign languages, and Mexico City was a hotbed of KGB activity back then. It was one of the largest Soviet embassies in the world, and so you know we had a big influence down there, a big part of it, and he got into it, and things are not as he expected them to be, and that's really the subject of the first book, The Jury Master, where, you know, things are represented to him, and they're not accurate, and he gets involved in some things he's not proud of, and he finally gets to the point where he walks away because he can't live with himself. And he goes to this farm on Camino Island up here in the Seattle area, and he lives a very humble existence, which changes dramatically in The Jury Master. In this particular instance, you know, Charlie thinks that his business is failing for sort of normal reasons that businesses fail, and so he gets involved in this not realizing that the failure of his business has been contrived. And it's been contrived to convince him to do what Carl Emerson asked him to do.
That's scary, to be manipulated to think something's going wrong even though it's not. And that's scary, because sometimes you don't even see it. You just get blindsided. So
right. And that was sort of what I was hoping to do was, you know, Charlie's a very intelligent man. He's smart.
Yeah.
He's resourceful. And so it had to be a situation where, you know, everything really played out as being true.
That's even scarier. So what did he propose? Now, he tells him what he wants him to do. And there's a lot of red flags that I would have wondered. And why did he agree to go to Moscow? I mean, and the scary part is he told him if, you know, you get caught, too bad. I would think twice
yeah,
the thing if you get that would be a red flag, seriously.
Yeah, but one of the that's something that CIA officers deal with all the time, according to the two individuals that I spoke with, and that is when you are in a foreign country and you are undercover, you're on your own. And if the government is not going to publicly acknowledge you. Now, in private, they might acknowledge you so that they can, you know, make a trade with whatever get you out. But publicly, they're not going to acknowledge you. And, you know, in this, so that's not an unusual situation for a case officer to find him or herself to be in. Charlie goes to Moscow because he's told by his former station chief, Carl Emerson, that there is an agent in Moscow that is hunting down a clandestine group of agents that have been operating in Russia for a number of years, called the Seven Sisters. The Seven Sisters is basically an acronym named after the seven buildings that Stalin built after World War II, which were called the Seven Sisters, and they were seven buildings. And so Emerson tells him that there's this eighth sister, if you will, which is also based on somebody who's hunting down these seven sisters and systematically eliminating them. And so Charlie's job, the proposal anyway, is that he goes over there and he finds the eighth sister. And once he finds the eighth sister, that he provides that information to the CIA and he gets out. But what he doesn't realize is he's being set up.
That's even scarier, because he's really smart, and I knew he was being set up. That I felt in my bones. And no matter how hard I tried to warn him when I was reading it, he didn't quite hear me. That's so sad. But, so what did, who is Fedorov? Now, let me tell you, this guy, this FSB agent, is really clever, and you either like him or you hate him, and he's like, I'm like in between about him. There was something about him that was, he was really smart, in a sense. So what role did he play? And he comes in contact with Charlie, but you can't really tell sometimes if he's friend or foe at times.
Yeah, so Fedorov is sort of the new age of the KGB. When Soviet communism collapsed and Perestroika was initiated, the FSB was basically dismantled. And what was put in place was the FSB, which is the Federal Security Service of Soviet, of the Russian government. And with Putin coming into power, it's becoming more and more powerful and more clandestine and looking more and more like the old KGB used to look like. And so Fedorov is an agent working in the FSB, and his job is basically to, when Jenkins shows up in Moscow, his cover is that he's a disgruntled former CIA officer who has information that he wants to sell. And he's selling it because eventually he wants to try to get to the eighth sister. And Fedorov is the FSB agent who Jenkins makes contact with in Moscow with this pretense that he wants to sell United States government secrets. So Fedorov gets involved with Jenkins and soon begins to realize that, you know, Jenkins is not over there for that purpose. And really what you have is just a classic espionage novel of cat and mouse, neither individual providing, you know, accurate information.
So tell us about his wife. And this is very clever, because a lot of people should do this. When you're on the phone with someone and you want to tell them something, he has a signal. And he tells his wife something that she should leave. And then we have Sloan. Why does he agree? Who is Sloan, and why does he agree to help him? And why would Jake, his nephew, do a better job, or maybe not do a better job? That was a brave thing to do.
Yeah. So Charlie's wife is also a former CIA case officer, and that's something that I learned when I went back and I visited the CIA headquarters in Langley a few years ago, is that a lot of agents marry other agents. And the reason they do that
is because otherwise they really can't say a lot about their job, and it becomes very difficult on a spouse if you have another spouse that can't tell you where they're going or what they're doing. So a lot of them end up marrying other CIA officers. And she is in the midst of her pregnancy, but she's also suffering from preeclampsia, which you know even adds more stress of Jenkins that he's got to do something to help his family. David Sloan is a Seattle-based lawyer who Jenkins got to know during the Jury Master, and then over the course of a number of years, he became Sloan's private investigator for many of Sloan's cases. And, you know, they're good friends. They're very good friends. And so when Jenkins gets in trouble, Sloan is there to try to help him on a number of different levels. And his son, Jake, who's now, you know, an adult, who's 3 years old, and in law school, he wants to help Charlie because he's grown up with Charlie. Charlie's helpful to him. And when he realizes Charlie's in trouble, he wants to do something to try to help.
How many kids would do that? Very few.
Pardon me?
Very few.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Very few. So what happens when we meet this character I really liked, Paulina and Anna? He meets her, so why does she say that she was going to help him? And why do we know she is no one to fool around with or take lightly? I liked her. She's a strong character, but don't mess with me, people.
Yeah, no, she is a lot of fun. So Paulina is – Jenkins believes that Paulina is the eighth sister who he needs to identify because she's killing the other seven sisters. And, again, nothing is as represented to him. And Paulina is really trying to find who is leaking the information about the seven sisters. And when Jenkins shows up in Moscow and starts using that term, she believes that he's one of the people that's responsible for the death of the sister. Basically, she goes after him with the intent of trying to kill him. She thinks he's a double agent and he's betraying his country. She's also a double agent, but she's working for the CIA. So, you know, it's one of those books where, you know, readers don't know exactly who's telling the truth and who isn't, and they're going to hopefully, you know, constantly be on edge as to, you know, what's the truth and what's going to happen.
Which explains why I picked up the book and put it down at all.
I appreciate
just,
it. Thank
but that you. Hasn't happened. That hasn't happened recently. This one, and I don't know if you've read David R. Dow, Confessions of an Innocent Man. That's another one you're going to sit down and shake by the time you read the end of the book. Like, oh my God. Yeah.
Wow.
It was excellent. I've gotten some really good ones, but this one, I'm telling you, everybody wants to read it, and a lot of people are going to read it. Why is Federer so bent on destroying Charlie? And he does everything in his power to get Paulina. And that was interesting that, you know, some of those scenes that you created.
Yeah, it's his job. You know, it's his job. It's what he does. He's an ambitious guy. And, you know, being successful in this situation will help him in his career. And it will help him. And the other thing is he has a strong sense of justice as well. I mean, you know, he's a lot like Charlie. But, he's a lot like Charlie. He just happens to be the antagonist in this situation. But he's only the antagonist because of circumstances. And the circumstances are he works for the FSB, and he knows that somebody is divulging information, you know, a double agent, and his job is to prevent that from happening. So he's trying to do his job to the best of his ability at the same time that, you know, Jenkins is trying to do what he thinks is his job to the best of his abilities, and that's where the clash comes.
That's what made it really interesting because, you know, at one point you hate this guy, and at the next point you really don't hate him. I'm not going to say why. Seriously.
Okay.
I'm really good at this, not saying what I'm thinking. So Charlie and Sloan decide to enlist the help of the FBI. That was a bad thing to do. So what happens when you want to, and then they arrest Charlie because guy was no good? That was interesting.
Yeah, and that's based on, you know, that's based on true events. You know, when a CIA officer's, what I was told was that when a CIA's officer goes sideways, they are basically supposed to get lost and not make contact and not get involved. And in this particular instance, because of what Charlie realizes is happening, he tries to get involved for good reasons. And so he makes contact with an FBI agent that Sloan has had contact with in the past, hoping to divulge that there is a mole within the CIA, but he doesn't realize how badly he's suspected, and soon comes to realize that goes as far as the FBI as well.
Well, then they arrest him. Then they do a polygraph test. Then they say he's not lying, but they don't want to give him bail. So how did you create, I can't stand, sometimes I wonder about the legal system. How did you seem to create a judge who really wanted to have fair and equitable trial, yet he came down on Sloan and denied bail? That sounded really like realistic to me, that would happen.
That is realistic, and that is what happened to the gentleman that helped me write the book. You know, you have to remember that when the judge gets involved, his initial belief is that he's dealing with a spy. He's dealing with someone that probably divulged secrets. And so, you know, the problem with granting bail is you might be granting bail to someone that has a number of fake passports, a number of, fake accounts all over the world, and you grant bail, and mean the person is experienced in disappearing, and they could disappear. So the denial of bail was initially not unusual, and so that really happens. But at the same time, in this particular case, the judge began through the course of the trial to realize that there was something more to the story than was being, you know, that the defense was able to divulge. And he takes some very egregious actions in order to make sure that the trial is fair.
Do most judges do that? Because I'm not going to tell you how I know. I mean, but through other experience, I've noticed that sometimes they just decide something and they have it in their mind, and that's just the way it is. So you created a judge that actually listened and wanted to hear both sides. Does that happen, or do they ever get prejudiced to one side?
Well, it definitely happened in this instance. I mean, they definitely had a very strong judge who began to suspect that there was some foul play going on, and he took matters into his own hands. I think that for the most part, most judges are like most police officers. They want to do their job, and they want their job well. Now, you're going to have some judges and some police officers that might be corrupt. You might have some that are lazy. You might have some that just don't care. But I think that it would be jaded to say that, you know, all judges are one way or all police officers are one way. That's just not the case. I think a large percentage of them, a very high percentage of them, are trying to do their job and trying to do it their ability.
Well, there was only one judge on this case, right? Just Judge Hardin? That was it. There was just one particular judge. Because I've noticed that, I've read 10,000 books, you know that. But sometimes when you have a judge and then they switch judges, but if the judges, I learned this recently, are on the same category, the same type of judge, whether it's the Supreme Court or appellate or whatever, that if somebody makes a judgment, they can't overturn it. They have to follow what that other person said. So in other words, they were lucky that it was only this one judge. Correct. I mean, that was.
A lot of cases, you know, go on for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And that's one of why you can have multiple judges is because, you know, the case takes place over the course of years. And, you know, judges get promoted or they retire or there's a number of different things that can happen. It can be very difficult because, you know, you can have a great judge at first and then get a judge that you don't like as much or vice versa. So, you know, it's just one of the things that happens in the judicial system.
Well, we've got a lot of people listening, I can tell you now. We've got host of A Good Story is a Good Story. We have Gerard DeMoraney of the Chris De Niro series, and everybody's commenting on what I wrote on Facebook, which is really good.
Wonderful.
And they're all reading it and listening. This is really good because you don't get too many people during the day, but we are. So when we learn more about Emerson, and then he was a strong character despite the fact that Fran didn't like him, we learn more about certain documents. Why would the court not want them as part of the testimony for the defense? And what was the government hiding? They were really trying to get Charlie. They didn't want him out, did they?
No, because there are documents that exist, and mm-hmm. There is a law that exists that allows the government to make documents unavailable if they believe those documents can hurt national security interests.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is based upon true events that you can have documents that exist. But that can't be divulged because they can cause irreparable damage, maybe national defense. And the government was using that to try to hide information, basically about what happened and why it had happened. And that's one of the conflicts that in the judicial system is our judicial system is based on finding the truth and the truth being revealed. But you have a number of different that can impact that desire, and one of those is, if you're going to divulge information that could have a national security problem, create a national security problem, that's one of the reasons why documents will not be divulged. In this particular instance, the documents were, in fact, the judge did not allow them into evidence. But then again, the judges are only human, and the judge knew what was in those documents, even though they could not be introduced into evidence.
That's scary. So how can one judgment be overturned by a group of others? So Judge Hardin is great. But what I have read so many books and so many opening statements and so on, but these were so real. So how did you create the scenes for the trial and the opening statements that I felt like I was in the courtroom with Charlie, with the team and the spectators? And usually when I read these things, I go like, oh, my God, not another group of opening statements that I'm going to fall asleep. This one is like, oh, my God, what are they going to say next? How did you create that?
Well, that was all based on an actual trial. And I did not have the trial manuscripts or the trial transcripts. Those were never received, but I did have the individual who was tried, and I did have his recollection, and I had newspaper clippings of the trial, and the newspaper clippings covered, what was said and who said it and how the opening statements opened. And so it was a matter of just doing a lot of research, reading a lot of everything I could get my hands on, basically, and then interviewing, as the person that was intimately involved in the situation. And I wasn't trying to make it a true story, but I wanted the events involved in the trial to be accurate in terms of the legalistic nature of them. And so I spent time, talking with the individual who went through this.
Well, that's probably why Associated Press is raving about the book, because it is. It's definitely credible, seriously. And after dealing with so many different law enforcement people that I've interviewed, I said, look, oh, my God, this is so real. And you really hit the mark on this one. So tell us about, it must be hard when a child sees his father taken into custody and listening to what others say about him. How do you explain this child without frightening them? And I have to give this kid credit because he stuck up for his father.
Yeah, when the book... So when the book, the first 300 or 350 pages of the book is just a classic spy novel. It's a cat and mouse game, and the tension comes in whether Charlie's going to be caught and how he's going to get away. What smart thing is he going to do to try to get out from what seems like an unwinnable situation? And so then when he returns to the United States, I was concerned about the shift from a classic spy novel to what becomes sort of a legal thriller. There's a different form of tension there, and I wanted to keep the tension as high as possible. And I just felt that the way to keep the tension as high as possible with the trial was to let the reader know what's at stake for Charlie. And what's at stake for Charlie is he's going to lose his family. I mean, he's basically going to be thrown in prison for the rest of his life. He's never going to see his son's, you know, baseball games. He's not going to see his soccer games. He's not going to be present at his son's parties. You know, he's gonna lose what matters the most to him. The reason why he went over to Russia is for his family, and he's going to lose that if he loses this trial. So I wanted the reader to know that just because Charlie was back, the stakes were still just as high as they were when he was running for his life and trying to get out of Russia alive.
It must be hard to it wasn't that hard for him to get in, but it was even harder for him to get out. And in reality, I don't think I'd want to go to Russia, seriously. I just wonder how many people actually do go there and find it hard to get in or hard to get out. I don't know. I'd be afraid to speak up. I don't know.
When I went over there, and I was over there for 3 weeks, I had trouble getting in. And that's all in the acknowledgement. Part of the story in my acknowledgments is I had trouble getting into the country. That was, you know, that was during the perestroika years when Russia was trying to become more open. But I would be nervous about going back. I travel quite a bit in Norway and Iceland, and I have to tell you, every time I travel, I'm just so impressed with the European people, the people I meet when I'm traveling, the people. I mean, they're just wonderful, salt of the earth people, and I'm sure 99% of the Russian people are wonderful people there. But what's happening with their government? And the clash their government is having with our government would make me very nervous to be there, you know, doing research for, you know, for books. It would be difficult. So what I was able to do is I was able to use my experiences over there. I was able to go back and look a lot of the law. I kept a blog when I was over there. I had a lot of photographs. And then I spoke to multiple people who also spent a lot of time over in Russia, and I was able to, talk to them about the Russian culture and the Russian people and a lot of those kind of things.
Well, the Russian embassy wouldn't help you, would they? They wouldn't talk to you at all? They would not allow you in there, I imagine. There has to be one here, I imagine, somewhere.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there probably is, but...
I wouldn't.
Yeah,
no.
I don't know.
It's really sad because I'm sure, like you said, there are a lot of people over there that would like to get to know people over here. And I had a friend a long time ago, one of the teachers in my school, that went there, and she actually had to share an apartment, and they had no privacy. And she said you had to be really careful what you said because you don't know who's listening.
Yeah.
That's scary. So we've got two more people. Who ran the company that Goldstone and Randy LSRNC, and why are their names keep coming up in this particular case?
Well, LSRNC was the company that Charlie's business was trying to protect, and a lot of that again was based on sort of true events, a whole different story, but based on true events. And so Charlie's company was a security company. Their job was to provide security for LSRNC Investments, which was opening offices, you know, in all over the world. And they needed the security to protect high-level investors that were coming into the office and things like that. And so, you know, again, what Charlie doesn't realize is that the company is not what it appears to be. It appears to be a legitimate investment company. But once he starts digging deeper, he starts to realize that it was something much different.
That's scary. Before I forget, next Wednesday, this should be very interesting. Dylan Volk wrote a book about his life, Bad Choices, Big Good Stories, and it's about his life with Asperger's autism spectrum. On the 8th, it should be interesting if he gets on. On the 18th, if you haven't read Redfish Oak, it's about the Plains Indians and their abuse and what they did to the white people and what we did to them. And it's based on a true story. George Putnam and Jewel Gutman will be here at a special time at 11. And somebody that we both know and love, on the 23rd, Strongest Deal, John Land. Who else could write it?
Oh, great.
And on the 25th, another person we love, David Burnsworth, caught up in it. And to end the month of April, Rachel and Michael, who created the opening for my show, created a new song, Lord, I Adore You, for the inspirational music, TrinityHouseEntertainment.inc. I listen to their music and I smile. I literally smile. And next month, the 7th of next month, why not start off with R.G. Belsky and Below the Fold? So that's just some of what this girl's going to be up to. So why does Charlie appear to be the scapegoat? And for a scheme that someone tried to bring him down, and yet Charlie seems to be orchestrating his own demise. How is he going to escape that or not?
Well, you know, that's sort of the $64 question, right, for the readers. You know, again, Charlie's very intelligent, and he goes into this with the best of intentions, and he does not realize the depth of the conspiracy that he is being dragged into until it gets to a point where it's too late. He has to make some real choices about, you know, how he can get out, and he needs to get out of the country for a lot of reasons. One is he's got a family at home waiting for him. The other is that he's now got information that, you know, that the government needs to know. I mean, there's a whole, whole lot of reasons that come into play about why it's so important for him to get home.
Why does he seem to be sort of getting, not a bond, but a lot of communication between him and Fedorov? And that was really amazing.
Because Fedorov, you know, what Charlie believes is that Fedorov is the agent that he is going to use under the pretense that he's divulging secrets in exchange for money, that he's betraying the country. And so there has to be a lot of clandestine meetings between Charlie and Fedorov. What I was told is that the Russian government is very slowly, that they're very cautious about these kinds of things, that they never jump into it, that they are going to try to push someone. You know, someone goes there saying they want to get paid for it. They're very deliberate. The Russians are very deliberate. The FSB is very deliberately. And so, you know, Fedorov's job is to try to vet Jenkins and see whether Jenkins is being honest and whether he's telling the truth, or, you know, whether he's doing something else. So, again, that was information that was provided to me about how they would handle a situation like that.
I'm wondering, this man that helped you, did he need some kind of help after he went through this? Did he need to talk to somebody? Was he able to deal with it? Or just by telling it to you, it made him better, made him able to account for what happened or deal with it? Because that's a hard thing to deal with, this whole thing.
Oh, extremely hard thing. But, you know, the thing about him was he never stopped loving his country. He made that very clear, that he loves his country and he never stopped loving his country. He got caught in sort of a bad situation in his particular circumstance, and he did the best that he could. And it was just a bad situation. Yeah, but he never lost faith in his country. He still made that very clear to me.
Would he go back there, or he was not allowed, or he can't go back there?
Go back where?
I mean, he's loyal to his country. I mean, seriously. That must have had an effect on him, yeah, I would imagine. So, Lassonde
sure
is a lawyer. Go on.
I'm sure that it did. I mean, I don't know how it couldn't. I mean, again, he was in a very, very difficult situation.
Yeah. I have to admire him for wanting to have his story told, seriously. So when the jurors hear how the case, how do we know that he's an expert lawyer, and how does he try to get the jury to be on his side? I mean, that's hard.
Yeah, no, it's extremely hard. That's sort of the number one thing that a lawyer has to do is, you know, I remember when I was trying cases, I had very experienced lawyers tell me that you win cases in opening statement. You can tell right away the opening statement whether you have a jury that's going to, you know, understand what you're doing and agree with you, and whether you don't. So Sloan is very skilled at what he does, and that, you know, that comes out in all the Sloan books that I wrote. But in this particular instance, he's not only very skilled, he's very motivated, because he's defending, he's defending, you know, someone that's become his best friend. And he realizes that stakes are very high. If he fails, his best friend is going to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Well, jury selection for a case like this is not the same as if it were a money case or malpractice or even a murder case. It's different. How do they choose the correct people? So how do you know when you're choosing a jury like this that you're getting people that are actually intelligent enough to understand what you're saying and not just there, you know, because they have no choice to be there?
Yeah, well, that's all a product of voir dire, which is an opportunity where the judge has an opportunity to question the jurors. And then to some extent, in federal court, it's much more limited than in state court. But in federal court, then the attorneys have a limited number of questions that they can ask the jurors to try to get a sense of how the jurors feel about a particular topic or a particular issue. And it's really, it's a skill. You know, when there are, like any profession, there are some lawyers that are just incredibly skilled and incredibly good at their profession. And Sloan is very good at his profession. And in this particular instance, a lot of the questions that Sloan raised, questions raised in real life at the first, to try to determine whether or not, or basically to try to determine what the jurors mindset was with respect to someone who's being accused of espionage.
This is dangerous because actually, I mean, he was lucky that he had a lawyer that was versed in what he had to do, and yet a jury that, well, I'm not going to say whether they listened or not. I'm not going to give that away. The verdict is unprecedented, and because it's a case that's a secret, I'm not going to tell you what the verdict was. But if Charlie could speak to our listeners, do you think he would do this over again? I think he would do the whole thing again the same way, or would he change how he did anything?
Well, I can tell you that the real person said that they would do it again because they operating. Yep, they were operating under with good intentions. He operated with good intentions, and he believed that the job he was doing was to help his country. In this particular instance, Jenkins' situation is different. I think he would tell you that. I think he would tell you that he'd be much more. He'd ask a lot more questions. That he would be much more deliberate in making his decision, and he wouldn't make his decision probably as quickly because of, you know, his own family concerns. And that's really what this is about. It's about, you know, balance. That act between, you know, helping your country and helping your family.
That's a hard decision that he made. I know that. And how did his wife really feel about him going there? Because she wasn't thrilled that he left either, I would imagine. And she had to go in to be, you know, keep safe in a different place. She couldn't stay where she was.
Yeah.
So how did she really feel about this?
Well, she's scared. I mean, you know, Yeah, she's a former CIA officer, and so she realizes all of the things that could possibly go wrong. And so she's scared. I mean, you know, she's scared for her husband. She's worried. She knows he's competent. You know, she knows he's good at what he does. But, you know, she also knows that, you know, things can go wrong quickly, and they can get out of control very quickly. So she's scared. She's afraid for her husband. And she's afraid for herself. You know, she doesn't want to raise two children by herself.
I know. You have a statement on page 450. I have the book in front of me. This is the one that I did. This is the one, the hard-covered one, the one that I didn't scribble in and write in. You know by now when I write it in the book, I write all over it. So this statement really says it all. We both know lives can change in an instant and in ways neither of us people can ever imagine. Isn't that true? In this case too, you just don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes it just does, which is really scary.
Yeah, every day is a new adventure.
I know it's and you have to appreciate every single day because you don't know whether good or bad or indifferent is going to happen. So
right.
I'm not going to say who the eighth one is. That was interesting. Let me tell you. But is there? Are you going to bring Sloan back and Charlie back and another one? Because I think everybody wants to know that.
Yes, I mean there's something that happens in the first book that really it leads to why Jenkins would ever go back. It had to be something very important, and so I'm in the process of writing the second book in the series, and I think there's going to be three books in the series. That'll be something that I talk in more detail with my editor about. I'm working on the second book. And have an idea for the third, but really they're Charles Jenkins books. They're not David Sloan books. They're really Charles Jenkins books, and I'm really really happy and thrilled that I was able to give Charlie his own platform, because I always liked him in the Sloan books and I always felt that he'd be a great character for us.
No, he is a great character, and I would have been disappointed if you didn't bring him back. But this is going to be an original one. This is not going to be based on the first book and the same person. It's going to be a different place and a different thing that he's going to do, even though he's going to work for the CIA.
Yeah, I'm not going to give away too much, but he will.
Okay.
He will be back.
And what about Jake? Because I like him. Is he going to be back also?
You know, I'm not sure. It's going to kind of depend. You know, like I said, the second book is really all Charlie. So I don't know to what extent I'm going to even bring Sloan into the next book.
Well, that's even better. But what else is coming out next before I ask two more questions about this book? Are you going to do another a Tracy book? I love her, too.
I have that I am working on. My publisher is now doing the copy edits, and that book will be out, I believe, the first of next year. And I'm working on the sequel to The Eighth Sister, and then I'll do another Tracy book. So it's gonna go Jenkins Tracy, and then beyond that I gotta kind of figure it out.
Well, don't you have other characters that I haven't read? Seriously. Do you have more than just Tracy and Charlie? You have another. You have David Sloan. You have David. You have a different one. You have another one also.
I have David Sloan. I also have a character I a novel called The Seventh Candle. And people want me to do a sequel to that book and bring back that attorney case. I wrote a book called The Extraordinary Life of Hell, which has done really remarkable. Yeah, it's just done incredibly well, but. You know, I don't think that's a book that lends itself to a sequel. It's a literary novel, and it's really a book I think that sort of just stands on its own. And I'm really happy with how that book came out, and I'm really happy with how readers have responded to that book. But I do have an idea for another literary novel. It's just a matter of honestly finding the time to write it, because I'm writing as fast as I can, but I just seem to have so many ideas, and what I really want to do is, make sure each book is as good as it possibly can be. I don't want to rush things.
Philip Margolin was on my show 2 weeks ago, and he has an idea for people that have ideas. He has a desk with cubbies, and in every one of his cubbies he has either newspaper articles or clippings or blog things or ideas that he keeps in each one. So he pulls them out to see what he's going to use to write his next novel. I thought that was really clever.
That is. Did you say that was Phil?
Phil, yeah. He is so amazing. The Perfect Alibi was fantastic, and he's so interesting, and the book is great. As a matter of fact, he's going to be joining me on June 19th with R.G. Belsky and Alan Topol and David Burnsworth. We're going to talk about strong female characters, and he said he wanted to be on that one. But, he has this desk with cubbies, he was telling me. And he said each one, if you have ideas, just stick them in the cubby hole or in a box or something so that you can pull them all out and see how they fit into a novel. And
that's
how
great.
He does it.
Yeah, that's great.
So what happens when... Really? He's phenomenal. He's a wealth of information, seriously.
Yeah, he's a great friend and just a really good guy. I love Phil to death.
I love him too, especially when he says he's going to be on my show and say, send me his book, and I don't have to ask for it. It's even better.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
What happens when Alex goes to the hospital? How is that handled? And what makes CJ, I love this kid, so special? He really is.
Alex going to the hospital is because of her preeclampsia problems.
Yeah.
And again, what I'm just trying to do is just keep the reader aware of the fact that, you know, this is a high stakes game of tension for Charlie, that there's a lot at stake, that there's a lot at risk. You know, one of the things with preeclampsia that women are told is to eliminate the stress from their lives, because mm-hmm. that's what's, you know, that can really impact their pregnancy. And of course, this is a situation where she and Charlie can't do that. Jake is a kid that in some respects I modeled after my own son. He's very intuitive. He's a sensitive kid, but he's very intuitive and he's very smart. My son was very much that way as a little boy, and he's that way as a young man. You know, my son was the kind of kid that could diagnose the situation and then make his own decisions about how much he wanted to get involved and how much he didn't want to get involved. I'll tell you one quick story. Joe, my son, talked about when he was in grammar school about how he stayed on sort of the periphery of the in crowd, the in kids. You know, he wasn't in the middle of it. He stayed on the periphery. And I said to him one day, I said, you know, Joe, why don't you get more involved and get more in there, you know, so the kids can, kids can get to know you better. And he said, I like being on the periphery, Dad, because I can see when they're going to get in trouble and I don't have to be a part of it. And he was just a young kid at the time, you know, when he made that analysis and made that decision. And that's what I wanted Jake to be. I wanted Jake to be a kid that was intuitive and you know, could figure things out. And so he doesn't just take it for granted that his dad's going to be okay. He knows his dad's in trouble.
Well, you know what? He's 100% right, your son, because I was the same way. My mother used to say to me, well, why don't you become friendly with this one or that one? And I said, why don't I just see who they really are? Because, you know, people think can be your best friend, and in 10 seconds later, they stab you in the back. So I was very happy to stay on the periphery, and I didn't want to be with the wrong crowd, and I didn't care about any crowd. I just wanted to be on the crowd that gets all A's. That was it. That was my goal. That was her goal, too. So learning the truth about everything, Charlie's enlightened and he learns the truth, but where can everybody find out more about you and your work? And I hope I get the next one, and I'll just tell Megan I want it. I mean, you're going to be using her forever, right? She is your main publicist.
I'm not sure whether Megan's going to be involved in my future books or not. She is fantastic. But I can certainly make sure that you get the books. Danelle Catlett at Amazon Publishing is a fabulous, fabulous publicist. She does a great job. And I'll just make sure that you're on that list.
Megan is great, because if somebody can't do something, like I realized you couldn't come yesterday, and she got me fast enough so I was able to change it to today. And I said, you know, anytime that it's a riot, because she sends me the book, and then with a little note, when would you like to do the interview? Like, she's not telling me that I'm just going to review it. I mean, so I've got so many, she's amazing. But I want to thank you so much. Are you coming to the Thriller Fest this year?
I will be there.
Oh, good. Then I'll get to say hi this time.
Yes, that would be good. I will look forward to it.
Yeah, me too. I want to thank you so much, everybody. It's a beautiful day outside. It's actually not freezing here. It's only 46 degrees. To me, that's a heat wave, considering it was 26 last week. You're in California?
I'm in Seattle.
Seattle, Washington. Oh, that's even better. And is it very cold there? It's freezing here.
Not bad today. Today is not bad. It's overcast and a little gray, but that's sort of normal for this year in Seattle. But it's warming up here.
It's getting there today, too. But I want to thank you so much. Everyone, have a great day. And if you haven't read The Eighth Sister, what are you waiting for? Thank you so much, Robert. Everybody have a nice day, and bye.
Bye-bye.